Backmore had dug his cremation pits along the bank of the river, and he and Hui passed along the ranks of fallen warriors laid upon their last couch of wood. It was the ceremony of farewell, and Hui paused and looked down at old Mago. In death, the garrison commander had a dignity which he'd lacked in life. "How sweet is the taste of glory now, Mago?" Hui asked him softly. And it seemed that Mago smiled in his sleep. Hui sang the praise of Baal, and then he lit the funeral fires with his own hand. Tanith was not upon the walls to welcome him when they marched back to the fortress of Set, but Hui found her in her own chamber. She'd been weeping, and her face was pale, with dark blue smears beneath her eyes. "I feared for you, my lord. My heart burnt within me, but I did not weep. I was very brave through it all, through all the horror of it. It was only when they told me that you were safe that I cried. Isn't that silly?" Holding her close, Hui asked, "Was it like the poet sang it? Was it glorious and heroic?" "It was horrible," Tanith whispered. "Horrible beyond my dreams of horror. It was ugly, my lord. Ugly enough to make me despair of beauty." She was silent then, remembering it all again. "You poets never tell of the blood and the wounded screaming and all the other things." "No," Hui agreed. "No, we never do." In the night, Hui woke and found that Tanith was sitting beside him on the couch. The night lamp was trimmed low, and her eyes were dark pools in her face. "What troubles you?" Hui asked. And she was quiet a few seconds before she spoke. "Holy Father, you are so gentle, so kind. How could you do what was done today?" Hui pondered the reply a moment. "It was my duty," he explained at last.
Your duty to slaughter those wretches?" Tanith asked incredulously.
"The law is death to rebel slaves."
"The law is wrong, then," Tanith declared hotly.
"No," Hui shook his head.
"The law is never wrong."
"It is."
Tanith was close to tears again.
"It is."
"The law, Tanith, is all we have that saves us from the void. Obey the laws and the gods, and you need never fear."
"The law should be changed."
"Ah," Hui smiled.
"Change them, by all means. But until they are changed, obey them."
In the dawn of the next morning, Lan and Hyrcanus arrived at Set. He arrived at the head of 2 full legions in battle array and 50 elephants of war.
"I fear, sire, I have been greedy," Hui told him at the gates.
"I left you not a single one."
And Lannan shouted with laughter and embraced Hui, turning to his staff with an arm still about Hui's shoulders.
"Which of you was it said that Ben-Ammon would not fight?"
That night, while he was still sober, Hui sung the ballad he had composed to commemorate the Battle of the River of Blood, and Lannan wept at the telling of it. And when it was done, he cried out to his own staff,
"3... against 30,000. It will always be our shame that we did not fight with Hui Ben-Ammon that day at Set."
Lannan stood.
"I give you the new commander-in-chief of all the legions of Opit. I give you Hui Ben-Ammon, axeman of the gods."
And then king and priests got very drunk together. Gondwani was one of the 200 tributary chiefs of the Vendi, and his territory bounded on the broken land of the Khal Gorge, the land of the outcasts. He was fat and prosperous, and because he was a prudent man, he regularly left small gifts of salt and meat at a place in the hills where the outcasts came for it. Also, because he was a prudent man, he gave food and shelter to solitary travellers journeying to the hills or returning from them. And when they left his town, the memory of their passing went with them. Thus a tall, gaunt stranger sat one night at his hearth, and ate his food and drank his beer. Gondweni sensed power and purpose behind the impassive, scarred visage with the fierce yellow eyes. He felt an unusual affinity for this man, and he talked more freely than was his wont. Although he spoke the language of Vendi, the traveller seemed to know nothing of the politics and affairs of the tribe, not even the name of the paramount king, who had succeeded Manatasi when he was carried off by the white devils from across the river. Of Manatasi's six brothers, five died swiftly and mysteriously, after drinking of a special brewing of beer prepared by the middle brother Kani. Kani alone survived the feast, and Gondweni chuckled and nodded and winked knowingly at the stranger. He is now our king, the great black bull, the collector of the tribute, the thunder of heaven, the fat lecher of Vendi, with his 500 wives and his 50 young boys. Gondweni spat forcefully into the flower, and then drank from the beer pot before passing it to the stranger. When he took it, Gondweni saw that the stranger's right hand was missing, and he steadied the pot with a stump.
What of Manatasi's counselors, his war captains, his blood brothers? The stranger asked. Where are they now?
Most of them are in the bellies of the birds, and Gondweni drew a forefinger across his throat expressively.
Most of them?
Some went over to the Kani and ate his salt. Others spread their wings and flew. Gondweni pointed out into the hills, which showed like the black teeth of an ancient shark against the moon sky. Some are my neighbors, chiefs of the outcasts, paying tribute to none, and waiting in the hills for they know not what.
Who are they?
Zingala.
Zingala, the ironsmith?
The stranger demanded eagerly. And Gonwene's expression changed. He turned on the stranger a hard stare. It seems to me you know more than is safe, he said softly. Perhaps we should sleep now. He stood up and pointed out a hut. There is a sleeping mat laid out for you, and I will send a young girl for your comfort. The stranger's need was like a raging storm on the girl's unresisting body, battering and driving, and Gondweni heard her crying out in pain and fear. He lay awake, troubled and restless. But in the dawn, when he went to the stranger's hut, the girl lay crumpled in exhausted sleep, and the man was gone. A deep gorge split the mountains, so deep that the path was dark and moss-covered and slippery underfoot. At the head of the gorge, a fall of silver spray plunged down from the cliffs above, and the wind drove it in a fine cold mist into Manatasi's face as he climbed upwards. At a level place he paused to rest, and the stump of his right arm ached cruelly in the cold. He ignored the pain, pushing it below the surface of his conscious mind, and he looked up the deep, dark gut of the gorge. High above him on the cliff top, outlined against the pale blue of the noon sky, was the foreshortened figure of a man. The figure stood very still, and the stillness was in itself menacing. Manatasi ate a little cold millet cake and drank from the stream of icy clear water before beginning the climb again. Now there were other figures. They appeared silently and unexpectedly at steep or easily defended places on the trail, and they watched him.
One of them stood atop a giant boulder, fully 40 feet high, which all but blocked the gorge. He was a tall man, well-muscled and heavily armed. Manatasi recognized him. The man had been a captain of one of his old regiments. Manatani stopped below the boulder and let the cloak fall back from his head, exposing his face. But the man didn't recognize him, couldn't see his king in this ravaged face from which pain and hatred had stripped the flesh and which the whip and the club had remolded.
"Am I so altered?" Manatasi thought grimly. "Will no man recognize me again?"
He and the man stared at each other for many seconds until Manatasi spoke.
"I seek Zingala the Ironsmith."
He knew that even though Zingala had joined the outcasts, such a famous craftsman must still have many clients seek him out. He knew that alone and unarmed, he would be allowed to pass on such business. The sentry upon the boulder turned his head slightly and pointed with his chin up the gorge, and Manatasi went on. There were narrow steps that climbed the black rock cliff beside the waterfall, and when Manatasi came out upon the summit, there were armed and silent men waiting. They fell in behind and on each side of him as he strode out along the only path through the thick forest which covered the crest of the mountain. The smoke of the furnaces guided Manatasi, and he came at last to a natural amphitheatre of rock, a bowl 100 paces across, where Zingala worked his art with iron. The old master was at one of his furnaces, packing the ore into the belly of it, each lump carefully hand-selected. His apprentices were gathered around respectfully, ready to add the layers of limestone and charcoal upon the ore. Zingala straightened up from his task and held aching back muscles as he watched the tall stranger and his escort come down into the bowl. There was something familiar in the man's walk, in the way he carried his shoulders, the tilt of his head, and Zingala frowned. He dropped his hands to his sides and shuffled uncertainly as the man's features touched a deep memory. The stranger stopped before him and stared into Zingala's face. Those eyes, yellow, fierce, and compelling. Quickly he looked down at the stranger's feet, and he saw the deep cleft between the toes. Zingala wailed and dropped onto his face upon the earth. He took one of Manatasi's deformed feet and placed it upon his own grey-frosted pate.
"Command me," he cried. "Command me, Manatasi, the great black beast, the thunder of the heavens."
The others heard the name, and they fell as though lightning had struck them down. And they cried, command us, black bull of 1,000 cows. Manatasi looked upon his band of outlaws as they grovelled about him, and he spoke softly, but in a voice that cut to the heart of each of them.
"There is but one command I give you, and that is, obey."
The furnace was shaped like the belly of a pregnant woman, and the entrance was slitted like her pudenda between spread thighs of moulded clay. To fertilize the smelting of ore, Zingala introduced the buckhorn nozzle of the bellows into the opening. The nozzle was shaped like a priapus, and the work was done in a strict ritualistic sequence while the apprentices sang the birth chant. And Zingala sweated and laboured like a midwife in his leather apron, pumping away at the leather bellows. When at last the plug of clay was drawn, and the molten metal ran in a fiery stream into the sand moulds, there was a murmur of relief and congratulation from the watchers. Using an anvil of ironstone, and a set of special hammers, Zingala forged the lion's paw with its five massive iron claws and its pad of solid metal. He filed and dressed and polished it. Then he reheated it and tempered it in the blood of a leopard and the fat of a hippopotamus. One of the skilled leather workers built a socket of green elephant hide and shaped it to fit the stump of Manatasi's right arm. The iron claw was fixed securely into the leather socket, and when it was strapped to Manatasi's stump, it made a fearsome artificial limb. Kani, the paramount ruler of Vendi and foppish half-brother of Manatasi, was with his women when the iron claw tore the top off his skull. The girl beneath him screamed and fainted with the shock of it.